Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up for Monday, April 6, 2026. Thank you for joining us on the program today. My name is Magnus Tewald. I'm your host for this hour. We got a great show lined up for you today. We have the municipal elections are starting to heat up. They don't come actually until November, but candidates are starting to declare or drop out and slates are falling into place. Lots to follow on that. We have a report on New West Mayor Patrick Johnson today, who's running again. We also have a report on the Vancouver Public Library's new Indigenous Storyteller in Residence, and a profile on fire ecologist Kira Hoffman, who's recently been honored by the National Geographic. In Nanaimo, we have a report coming from Nanaimo. We have a report about how new street banners in the city are going to be produced by one of the city's youngest artists. We also have, of course, Gardening with Embark, and Peter R.H. will be here with his commentary at the end of the show. It's a beautiful day out there today, maybe a little cloud, but once you finish listening to this program, I hope you'll get out and enjoy some sunshine. Okay, here we are with Danny Nesvadarani's report on how things are shaping up in
reporting from New Westminster, BC, this is Danny Nesvadarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. On March 31st, New Westminster Mayor Patrick Johnstone announced that he will be seeking re-election in the city's upcoming municipal election later this year in October. The announcement took place inside Pizzeria Ludica, a local pizza restaurant in New Westminster. And shortly after doors opened, the restaurant was packed with fellow city staff, councillors, and supporters of Mayor Johnstone and Community First New Westminster, the municipal political party the Mayor Johnstone is a part of. CJSF attended the event, and before the official announcement, we spoke with Mayor Johnstone about his plans to run for a second term as Mayor of New Westminster. The first question we asked is, why are you running for mayor?
Because I love the city. I'm really proud of the work that we've done in the last 3.5-4 years in the city, and I recognize that we've got a lot more work to do. So I think that we've got a great team, and we're creating great momentum in New Westminster, and I want to keep that momentum moving.
We then asked Mayor Johnstone if he has plans to change the way things are currently being governed in City Hall if elected once again in October.
I think the biggest thing is we are on a great momentum right now, and we want to keep on moving it forward. We're doing great work on affordable housing in this city. We've got 3 affordable housing projects under construction right now. We've done so much work on renter protections and doing that kind of work to deal with affordable housing. Yet we still have seniors afraid about being able to age in place. We still have young families who can't get that extra bedroom when they have another kid. We've got people living on the street in New Westminster. So we have more work to do on that front. I'm really excited about the next phase in recreation investments in the city and parks and recreation spaces. We just introduced our new parks and recreation plan, and we can now start building some of those facilities. Excited about that work. I'm excited about a Vision Zero work and making our roads safer. I'm excited about our momentum on climate action and youth empowerment in the city. There's a lot of good things going on in this city, but we just need to keep moving forward.
Since becoming mayor in 2022, Johnstone and the councillors affiliated with Community First New Westminster have held a majority on council, with city councillors Daniel Fontaine and Paul Minhas representing the New West Progressives, a party that is often in public opposition with Community First. Councillor Fontaine, who is regularly debated with Mayor Johnstone over council decisions, has also announced that he will be running for mayor at the end of this year. And we asked Mayor Johnstone if that has had any effect on the council's dynamic or governance leading up to the next municipal election.
I mean, there's a lot of debate in council, and there's a lot of spirited debate on council, but ultimately, we're still getting the work done. I'm glad that we have a majority of people on council who vote for affordable housing, who vote for climate action, who vote for our great approach to community engagement. We've got a lot of positive work going on at council, and the majority of council is voting for it, and that's important. Debate's important. It's important to make sure that we're checking on the work that we're doing and checking with the community all the time on the work we're doing. But we don't want to let it stop our momentum.
After a row of speakers from community members to city councillors, Johnson went up last and gave the official announcement that he'll be running for mayor for a second term in New Westminster. This has been Danny Nezvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca. Reporting from Vancouver, BC, this is Danny Nezvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. The beginning of March this year, the Vancouver Public Library announced its 2026 Indigenous Storyteller in Residence, Nishka Theatre Artist C. Peel. VPL's Indigenous Storyteller in Residence program was first developed in 2008 to highlight the importance of storytelling as a way to learn about and from Indigenous communities throughout Vancouver. C. Peel is an actor, director, writer, dancer, and producer who has worked in various art spaces throughout BC, including his work as the Indigenous Outreach Coordinator at the Kulch and his work as the Artistic Associate at the Carmen Arts Group. CJSF reached out to C. Peel to learn more about what he's working on for this residency, and during our conversation, we discuss some of what he hopes he's able to achieve as VPL's Indigenous Storyteller in Residence. In his own words, he hopes to destabilize the notion that people understand what Indigenous means.
It's already tricky enough to land opportunities as an Indigenous person, and it's tricky to find opportunities that allow for the dignified self-agency to determine what exactly the position can mean. It's tricky to find opportunities like that, meaning that a lot of opportunities will sort of have an often subconscious assumption of what indigeneity is, and that can sort of set the stage for a potential limiting on what the true possibilities are for Indigenous people to create art and to self-express, because there's this potential for the understanding to impair who gets selected, because you don't necessarily fit the understanding of what indigeneity is as opposed to what it can be.
This sentiment from C. Peel is something that can be seen throughout all of the programming and personal projects that he's working on during his time as the Indigenous Storyteller in Residence for the VPL. Specifically, one of the events that he is hosting is titled Pretendianism. Pretendianism is the term that has been given to a social phenomenon in which someone has publicly and falsely claimed Indigenous identity, often for some form of personal gain. And we asked him why it was important for him to tackle that subject in particular.
What is our understanding of the word going into the conversation before we even start the conversation around indigeneity, pretendianism, opportunity? All of these big, enormous conversations, before we even get there, can we just sit with the curiosity towards what our current understanding is? Because to not do so sets the stage for the continuing reoccurrence of the phenomena. Not that it's going to stop the phenomena, but if we can carry an open-ended curiosity around why does this thing keep happening? I mean, we've got clear reasons, like I mentioned, it's the opportunity, it's the money, it's the acclaim, all of these benefits that can go along with landing a position in a prestigious organization, like not specifically that this has happened, but like a position like what you might find as the Indigenous Storyteller in Residence at the Vancouver Public Library, where it's well-funded, got access to the public, it's got access to all of this other stuff. I feel like it's so vitally important to not leave anything unsaid when it comes to these conversations, because it's not enough to just have a position available It's also important in the conversation of decolonialism and reindigenization and cultural evolution to be willing to sit with the discomfort that can come from a potential misstep in, oh, this institution hired somebody and it turns out they're not indigenous. I think that a part of the journey needs to be, well, no, let's just unpack that. Let's talk this through. And before we even get to the point where it actually occurs, before we even get to that point, can we just sit down and talk about what this actually is?
One of the last things we spoke about with C. Peel was the personal project he's developing as part of his role as the Indigenous Storyteller in Residence. He gave us an in-depth overview of the project, explaining how it relates to many of the other questions that he is posing throughout this residency.
So a question that I've been sitting with that is at the heart of my personal project here at VPL, as well as it had been at the heart of a different project, so I'm looking to figure out how does the question manifest in a different form. But the question is, what comes to your mind when I say the word Indigenous? And how did that get there? How did that understanding get there in the first place? What set the stage for that understanding? The first iteration of the project was a dance theater piece that I developed in a residency with Raven Spirit Dance. They are an Indigenous dance company here in Vancouver. I spent about a year in a developmental residency where I worked alongside a mentor to work on a personal project. And that was 2024. I worked with Yvette Nolan, an Indigenous artist, fantastic, outstanding artist, really, really insightful. And in one of our conversations about the project and about the nature of it, she had said something that ended up becoming the title of that version of the piece, which was that a lot of the things that I'm sort of sitting with and unpacking with as an Indigenous person, these are the things that I cannot unknow. And so that became the title, The Things I Cannot Unknow.
To learn more about C. Peel's work and some of the events that are going to be hosted during his time as the Indigenous Storyteller in Residence at the Vancouver Public Library, you can go to vpl.ca/storyteller. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can find this piece on frequencynews.ca. You can also find our full-length interview with C. Peel on cjsf.ca.
This is Bird Note. One of the biggest threats to birds is the decline in biodiversity due to habitat loss. And the traditional manicured lawn isn't helping. Even birds who visit backyard feeders, like these black-capped chickadees, need a healthy mix of seeds, berries, and insects, often found on the native plants that we villainize as weeds when they grow in our lawns, says ecologist Douglas Tallamy.
We have more than 40 million acres of lawn in the U.S., which is the size of New England, and that's an ecological deadscape.
That means one of the easiest ways to protect birds at home is to grow native plants, says Tallamy, who co-founded an organization called Homegrown National Park to help people transform their lawns into havens for wildlife.
I'd love people to stop looking at their yard as an isolated ecosystem. It's part of a neighborhood, and somebody's got a sunny spot down the street but no trees. Okay, that's where the pollinator gardens go. Somebody's got a giant oak and is overspreading two or three yards. That's great. That's going to provide a lot of resources for many of the houses in that yard. So look at your neighborhood as an entire local ecosystem and see what the total resources are.
Reducing your lawn to make room for native plants is a small step forward.
But imagine if everybody did this. This is why we call the Homegrown National Park movement a grassroots movement. It's a call to action.
To learn more about Homegrown National Park, start at our website, birdnote.org. I'm Ariana Remmel.
The annual Sled Island Music and Arts Festival is back June 17th to 21st, presented by Service Credit Union. Experience 5 days of music, comedy, art, and much more in diverse venues across Calgary, Alberta. Joining Sled Island's previously announced guest curator, Clipping, is English Chamber Folk Ensemble, Black Country New Road, revered Canadian pop project Homeshake, renowned abstract rapper Billy Woods, LA synth punks Sextile, fuzzy indie rock outfit Feeble Little Horse, outlandish egg punk group Snooper, lo-fi post-punk duo Sweeping Promises, New York City-based ambient pioneer Laraji, genre-bending dream pop artists Salami Rose, Joe Lewis, and many more. Plus, there are over 150 more artists still to be announced. Check out the current lineup and get your passes and tickets at sledisland.com.
Are you a fan of industrial and have been trying to find smaller artists? Have you only heard of Nine Inch Nails and are looking to get further into the genre? Maybe you're like that guy I met in my lecture who hadn't even heard of Linkin Park. No matter where you're coming from, Wire & Nerve is the show for you. 1 hour of all kinds of industrial, from Throbbing Gristle to Godflesh to Frontline Assembly and more. Tune in Mondays 7 to 8 p.m. only on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby.
Time for the weather. Looks like we're going to have a pretty good week here in the Vancouver region. Sun is going to be the story through most of the week until Friday, with temperatures up into the high teens towards the end of the week. Lows overnight down to 3, a little warmer later in the week. Great for your gardening. Beautiful weather, lots of sun for your plants, and nice weather to get out into the garden with. Things are going to take a little turn towards the end of the week, with clouds coming in on Friday night and a mix of showers and cloud seemingly throughout the rest of the weekend. Hopefully we'll see a bit of change in that. But for this week anyway, nice weather. Get some of your light clothing out and get out in the sunshine.
This is CICK News. Each year, National Geographic highlights a group of people it believes are shaping the future. Scientists, activists, artists, and storytellers tackling some of the most urgent challenges of our time. Launched in 2025, the National Geographic 33 is a global recognition of 33 individuals working at the front lines of issues like climate change, biodiversity loss, and social equity. Inspired by the organization's original 33 founders, the initiative celebrates people who aren't just studying problems, but are actively working toward solutions in their communities and around the world. This year, one of those honorees comes from Northern BC. Dr. Kira Hoffman, a fire ecologist from Smithers, has been named a 2026 National Geographic 33 honoree for her work alongside Indigenous communities to reintroduce cultural burning, a practice that not only restores ecosystems, but could play a critical role in reducing the severity of modern wildfires. Her work is part of a growing global shift in how we understand fire, not just as a threat, but as a tool for renewal and resilience. I spoke with Dr. Hoffman about what this recognition means and about the work happening right here in Northern BC that's gaining this international attention.
My name is Kira Hoffman, and I'm a fire ecologist, and I work at the University of British Columbia in the Center for Wildfire Coexistence and also at the Bulkley Valley Research Center in Smithers. I feel incredibly honored and humbled and excited to be recognized, as well as the three nation partners that I work with here in the Northwest. I just feel grateful for National Geographic for supporting my work. I've been a grantee since about 2018. I got my first National Geographic grant, and they've really been wonderful at supporting the work. So I was named individually, but they really talked about my collaborative work and how that makes my fire ecology work possible. So with the Chisalata Carrier Nation at the Office of the Wet'suwet'en and the Gitignau Nation as well. So those three partners have really supported my work, and in turn, I've supported capacity building with training and the ability to make cultural burns to bring the story of how critically important they are for this ecosystem and the people who live here more broadly.
Do you think that that also just helps bring more awareness to cultural fire, prescribed burns, natural forests?
Yeah, it definitely does. It's a very critical practice that's happened here for millennia. And I think it's really important that the public is more aware of the benefits of fire, not just cultural fire, but also natural lightning fire as well, because we live in these fire adapted ecosystems. So the big thing that's missing from many of the places we live is fire. We just have been excluding it for a long time. But that's changing. And I think the story of fire is one that's very, like, it's deeply human. So I think in many ways we can all connect to our feelings around fire. Like, we usually feel really good when we're sitting around a campfire. We usually feel really bad when we see the devastating impacts of wildfire that we become more used to. So yeah, my work, and this is why it's part of the change makers. They came together to kind of think how they could support the globe, how they could be change makers. And so this annual award recognizes people who are pushing kind of the envelope in their fields. It's a very cool opportunity to be a fire ecologist in a rural community in Canada and be recognized among people that I very much so admire.
Or how does this award actually translate to affecting your work? Do you feel like this opens doors or kind of brings any more attention to your work and even maybe even the area of Northern BC to the world?
Yeah, I think it does. I think that people are really looking for ways to connect with nature and ways to connect more with ecosystems. And this is just one of those stories that allows people to see the benefits to, again, like a disaster, essentially, that we become really used to. So I think it does alert people to the fact that there's really good positive things going on, and that there's many people who are thinking about climate change. There's many people who are thinking about the well-being of ecosystems and human health. It's a great reminder of the good work that's going on. My focus is still the same. It's about really producing the science so that we can understand more about how plants interact with fire. And so I am trying to understand more about some of the genetic side of plant communities that have always evolved with fires, like how our landscapes evolved with fire. And some of the issues that we're seeing right now because they're not able to absorb fire any longer. So I'm thinking about that in a social sense, but also a biophysical sense. I'm just about to go into burn season, and that usually lasts about 6 weeks or so. I'm always up for, you know, sharing work and hopefully do that again soon.
Here. Is there an actual physical award that you have?
It is not a physical award, but yeah.
Was there anything else that you wanted to just let people know, either about what you're working on?
Just that, you know, we are continuing to support cultural fire in this area. We have a few burns planned with some of the nation partners, and it's an opportunity for the public to just become more aware of some of these practices. And so if you hear about them, you know, you might have people that say that's a lot of work for a fire, or we don't want to see smoke in the community. I think it's just really important to educate yourself on, learn about this incredible cultural practice.
Thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me about this today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
CSK News is funded by the Government of Canada, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and is a participating station in the Local Journalism Initiative. On behalf of my colleague Dan Messick and myself, Pam Hassan, thanks for listening.
This is a C2R News update. In the face of a global biological crisis, a Vancouver Island research group is using new environmental DNA techniques to help better understand some of the coast's smallest fish. Project Watershed, located out of the Comox Valley, has been monitoring surfsmelt and Pacific sand lance, two different species of forage fish found around the coast of Vancouver Island. While these fish may be small and less desirable for humans to eat, these fish are valuable parts of the ocean ecosystem, as they are food for some of the ocean's top predators. In monitoring the population of forage fish along the Salish Sea, Project Watershed joined a team of researchers at the University of Victoria to find new methods for collecting environmental DNA. Jacqueline Huard, forage fish project lead at Project Watershed, says environmental DNA, or eDNA, is DNA collected not directly from an animal, but from environmental samples such as soil, water, air, and snow.
So as any animal, but especially fish that we're focused on, as they move through their environment, they're constantly sloughing off and like shedding bits of DNA. So it could be from hair, or in the case of fish, it'd be like scales or slime, or especially when they're spawning and they're dropping eggs or sperm into the environment, like it's just full of DNA. And so we can go around and pick up water or sand and then look for traces of DNA in that sample.
For the last 8 years, Project Watershed has been using eDNA to detect tiny traces of genetic materials fish leave behind on the sand at beaches.
And so right now, when we go to a beach, usually we collect about a cup of sand from each beach, which is like made up of many tiny little scoops, you know, like 30 to 100 little scoops across the beach of sand. And then we take that sand, we put it in the freezer, and we get it down to her lab, or right now when we're using many, many samples, we send it to another lab all the way in Guelph. And then they look in that sand for DNA of sand lance and surf smelt.
They have been sampling beaches around Vancouver Island to collect and monitor the eDNA left by the forage fish. One small hurdle in research occurred when some local First Nations did not want materials removed from their territories due to cultural significance or a site being sacred. This included sand from beaches. Temporarily, eDNA monitoring was halted until a culturally respective solution could be found. From this, Project Watershed worked with the forage fish researchers at the University of Victoria and developed a new collection method called the floppy dip.
It's like a special piece of paper. It's like the size of a toonie, and it's charged, and so it can grab DNA. And so what we do is we go along the beach, we collect the sand as if we normally would. We put it in a Ziploc bag, very high-tech tools, and then we add some regular drinking water that would have no chance of having come across their DNA before. So we add that in, we add in that special piece of paper, and we shake it around. You shake it around for a minute. I like to think of it as our shake and bake technique. And then we take that piece of paper out, and we add it to like a little envelope with some silica packs and we send that to the lab instead of the sand, and the sand can get put back on the beach immediately. We don't have to take it away from the beach at all.
Huard says while different species of forage fish can be found around the world, with some countries heavily researching the fish or even commercially fishing them, there is still a lot of unknowns when it comes to local species.
About them, and we're gaining more momentum for where these species are and like what predators eat them and how important they are to the ecosystem. But it's still largely a mystery. We don't know how well the populations are doing. We don't know if they're growing or collapsing.
They say that monitoring and understanding these fish means supporting other species like salmon, whales, and the endangered marbled murrelet that use the fish as food. Huard says that with their eDNA data, they have been able to create a habitat sustainability model for forage fish on the Salish Sea.
And that habitat suitability model, built on citizen science data, is now being used by DFO and other land managers like First Nations or regional areas, but especially by DFO in their permitting department when they're looking at whether or not a project should go forward. So if someone says, hey, we want to build a dock here, or hey, we want to build this big terminal like RBT2, Roberts Bank Terminal 2, DFO now has a tool to look at and say, hey, is there habitat for specific sandlands here? When previously sandy habitats were not considered to be used by a lot of fish, and so it wasn't really that like highly valued by managers.
With this model, Huard said it helped mitigate the impacts to the local forage fish habitats. Now Project Watershed is working to create a habitat sustainability model for the west coast of Vancouver Island. After collecting data for the last 3 years, they hope in future years they'll be able to conduct further research and build sustainability models for the Queen Charlotte Strait, Queen Charlotte Sound, and the Central Coast and Haida Gwaii area.
As you might imagine, there are there's First Nations everywhere, but they dominate for sure in the North and Central Coasts in terms of like land managers. And I think that there will be more places where we will need to use this technique so that we're not taking sand away. The beaches.
Huard says that not monitoring forage fish creates an unknown. Lack of monitoring these key species could lead to devastating but preventable effects on the ocean ecosystems if they were to collapse before action can be taken. For CHY News, this is Laura McKenzie.
This report was made with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and listeners like you. You can find more news updates, interviews, and stories from our nonprofit newsroom, as well as our news and current affairs podcast, Midcoast Morning, at chly.ca/news.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia.
It's back to school season. If you have unused tech in your home or office, consider donating it to BC Technology for Learning Society so schools, nonprofit organizations, and low-income individuals can have better access to technology. Donating is safe, easy, and helps people in your community. If you want to donate or to request refurbished equipment, you can learn more at reusetechbc.ca.
Welcome, Pablo Vimas, our gardening's expert. It's time for Gardening with Embark.
Nice to be here.
Thanks for coming in. We're into week 14. We're really at the real gardening season starts right now, does it not?
That's it. Yes, you are right. So on the 21st of March, we celebrated the equinox. Yeah. We were very happy. And the days just started getting longer and longer. Then last weekend, we had the average, the 28th of March, which is the average last frost here for Metro Vancouver. So the winter officially kind of ended.
Yeah.
And week 14 is the week that we start really now gardening and preparing the garden and going through all the chores for a good season.
So it's a pretty rainy time. We've had, over the last few weeks, we had a huge atmospheric river, then some days of bright sunshine, and then we're kind of settling into that rhythm of a bit of sun, a bit of rain, a bit of sun, and a bit of rain.
Yes, so slowly we are warming up, and yeah, this is a combination of sun and rain. So this week we had a bit of rain. That for us as a people, it's not the nicest weather to work. But if you see from the garden's perspective, is that, yeah, this is the time that we should be planting little seedlings or small plants in the ground.
Yeah.
The fact is that it's very cloudy, high humidity, and the soil is moist. So if we get our seedlings that we've been growing indoors, or you go to the nursery and you get your seedlings, this is the right time to transplant them, because there is little shock. The plants don't get into a shock.
Right.
What happens is around May, when we have long sunny days, and you go and put your plants, and after 2 hours you will see your plant wilting, kind of dehydrated, and you start watering there. So at the moment, that is not the case. So it's the right moment to plant all our leafy greens.
And that gives them a chance to, I mean, the conditions are right, but it also gives them a chance to get established and start growing where they're a little more resilient.
Yes, yeah. So less high humidity, so less dehydration, nice cloudy days, no direct sunlight, so the plants slowly adjust to the new environment.
Mm-hmm.
And as well, because the soil is moist, so the roots of the plants just tend to grow where the water is, so they start looking for water, settling a good root system.
So when we're putting the plants into the ground, what are the things we need to think about and watch for?
Yes. So you go to the nursery or you get your plants, and remember, we should remember that there is one seed, one plant.
Yeah.
Right. And so if you have your seeds, you will make sure later you have to remove thin up the seeds, the extra plants that you don't need.
Mm-hmm.
So when you go to the gardening center, you get a clump of plants sharing a clump of soil. So several plants sharing a clump of soil. The first thing is to break. Don't worry about breaking the roots.
Yeah.
That was okay. But you need to separate each plant from that block of soil. And then you locate or find the spot where you want to put a plant. And you will do a pocket, so you a small hole, and wider but not too deep, wider than the soil in the plant, around the root system, and then you put your plant in there in that pocket, which is wider, not too deep, and then once it's there, you just fit in there, and then you fill the hole with nice soil around, and you press it down.
Yeah.
So making sure that the roots have a good contact with the soil, and there is no air pockets in there, because air pockets means no water, and the roots will have a difficult to grow in through this air pocket. So, and then this also remember to keep your plants upright. Keep the plants upright, okay? So, and then here is the point that you start looking into which planting system you are going to use.
Yeah.
So if you are growing into rows, so you will try to plant your vegetables in a row at the right distance already, because we are using seedlings. If you are using the square foot gardening, you know that you will have a certain number of plants per square, and so it goes way, way dense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the only thing we had to care at this moment is that no trample too much the soil, because it's moist. So if you get into the soil, everything will compact under your foot. It will get muddy. Yeah. So what we usually do is put a plank of wood, and you walk on the plank.
Right.
So the weight, your weight does distribute into the soil, and it's not just in one spot that you sink. So that's,
and also I guess compacting the soil when you step on it.
Yeah, you step quiet. So that's why, as well, garden beds are designed 4 feet wide by 8 feet long.
Right.
So we can work from the pads. And with our arm, we can reach to the middle. So two feet to one side, and then you go to the other side, and 2 feet into the garden.
Yeah.
So that's why, if you have more than that, that's difficult. So it's wider than 4 feet. That's quite difficult, because now you need to get in the garden bed and start trampling the soil.
Right. Excellent. Well, you know, once they're in the soil, how often are you watering?
That's another interesting question. It all depends on your soil. Yeah, so if your soil is very clay soil, very heavy, you will have to add water slowly until it holds you moist, because the soil doesn't absorb water faster. If you have a sandy soil, on the other hand, the water will just go through.
Right.
So you will have to water more often, because the water will evaporate or also drain. So with this weather at the moment, I will say once a week is more than enough.
Yep.
Until we get mid, from my experience here in campus, once we get at the beginning in June, when the weather is well, we water twice a week. Twice a week, because we use engineered soil, so the soil does tend to dry. Besides, our garden beds have received lots of sunlight, so they dry out very quick. So twice a week. Usually, I advise to everyone do on Friday before we go for the weekend.
Yeah.
And then we do again the second watering on Tuesday.
Yeah.
The fact is that once you get off campus, no one is returning on weekends. I have to water my plants. No one is returning.
Yeah.
So everyone, most of our gardeners know that by Friday the garden has to be watered.
And that's good for home gardeners too, because often as you head into summer, you're going to be away or busy on the weekend. So why not get that watering done at other times of the week?
Yes, And watering usually is done in the evenings for home gardening or early in the morning. Here in campus, we do at any time of the day, because the approach that we do for watering is we water the soil, not the plant.
Yeah.
So the soil needs water. The plants take water from the soil. So plants don't need a shower. You water the soil. So there is a bit of confusion. Water the plants. So you go and give it to the plants a shower when you should be watering the soil.
Right.
So the other thing that we gardeners are eager is I want to put all my root vegetables. You start direct seedings, so this weather is not the best to work with seeds.
Right.
First of all, there is high humidity, so it's very moist, so your hands will get wet. If you get your seed packets off from your pocket, in 5 minutes that packet or paper is all soaking wet.
Right.
And if you are using your seeds, you put in your hands, and then everything gets stick into your hands. If you are working with tiny seeds, how am I getting the seeds off from my fingers? Then if the seeds that you have no use, you put it back in your pocket, but all of that have already absorbed moisture from the air. And then you have to get home and dry that packet and those seeds, putting in a place where it's warm and dry up. Otherwise, if you just put in your seed container and you forget, the next week you would see that everything is germinating, and you wonder what I did, what's wrong. Everything is germinating. Well, it's the fact that there was moisture already in there.
So it only takes a little bit of moisture to...
It does, yeah.
So you really need to be conscious of that when you're working with your seeds.
Yes, yeah. So when we work with seeds, we need a dry, sunny weather.
Yeah.
Dry, sunny weather, so that's the best for seeds. Working with seeds, this cold, cloudy, rainy weather, good for seedlings.
So is there a particular time or week, or are we just looking for a bit of a dry stretch?
Oh, no, really. We gardeners, we put your raincoat and you go.
I mean, like for the seeds.
For the seeds.
Like planting the seeds.
Usually is any time. As long as it's dry.
Right.
Yeah, as long as it's dry. So no rain at all. So if you have for instance, been raining and you have 2 hours dry period or sun, you can do in that time.
Yeah.
Yeah, but again, being very cautious that your packet don't touch any seeds.
Right.
Your seed packet doesn't touch any water.
Right.
Yeah. Now, if you are going thinking, okay, I need to start gardening, need to get my seedlings from the garden center, you visit the garden center, and there is so many plants that you can just spend hours in there. The only thing that you have to keep in mind is that you want plants that are small and well compact. that they don't present any sickness, sign of sickness, so no yellow leaves.
Yeah.
There is no chew leaves either, because it means that the insects being feeding right. from that. Tochu plants, if you are going to buy tochu plants to see underneath, there are no aphids. Nurseries as well containing aphids. So it's like, no, because they are professionals, the insects sometimes get in there and you don't notice. So make sure that, and make sure that the roots are not poking out from the soil, from the pot as well, because it means that there is a lot of roots bounded in the pot already. What you should avoid is plants with long roots. So you can see already the root mats are on top of the pot. They are very long, very long and thin plants, very skinny, yellow leaves. So yeah, you try to avoid those plants. Try to get with plants that look healthy. I know that sometimes at the end of the fall we have those plants that haven't been sold over the summer, and they are stunted, which means they have grown very thin, leaves are yellowish, and that means those plants you put in your garden, but they won't develop further.
Great. Well, now we're at that point of all the work and preparation over the winter, and the early spring is coming to fruition whenever. Well, not quite coming to fruition, I guess, but we're getting things in the ground.
Yes, we are start now getting things in the ground. So let's prepare. The weather is hopefully improving, and now it's time to start our seedlings in the ground, and soon we will start with our seed. One other thing is not. Don't try to plant all your garden bed at once.
Oh, yeah.
Because sometimes we get carried out, you go and buy plants, and suddenly you have more plants at the space that you get.
Right.
You have it. And then you're like, remember, we use the square foot gardening approach, is one kale, one broccoli, one cabbage per square.
Right.
So now if you have a box with 16 squares and you just get six kales and six cabbages, you already have 12.
Right. 12 almost plants. Your whole box is used up.
Yeah, the whole box is used up. So there's not much space for putting anything. So if you have done that, you start thinking, what else I can plant, or which other approach I can use? So then we tend to go to intercropping. So put other crops in between these big plants that we already use for filling the whole garden bed.
Excellent. Well, it's an exciting time of year. Thanks for coming in today, Pablo.
It was a pleasure to be here. And if you want to know more about Embark or what we do, please visit our website at EmbarkSustainability.org. Follow us in our social media channels at Embark Sustainability. And as well, follow the work that our spring cohort is doing right now in our Instagram account at Embark Gardens.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much, Pablo Vimas. Pablo Vimas of Embark Sustainability. We'll see you again next week.
See you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Rich is here now to talk about a meeting you went to just earlier this week.
Yes, on Monday from 4 p.m. to 5:30 at SFU downtown.
And SFU, of course, has a lot of different public events and meetings. What was this one about?
This was some people from the U.S. Consulate General in Vancouver. There wasn't any security for the event. Mm-hmm. There was a number of people were there.
Yeah.
And all what you had to do was some a register.
Right.
There was no kind of like, I'm sorry, you can't come here.
Was there a sort of specified topic they were going
to? It was about Canadian and American relations, trade relations.
Right. So definitely for many what might be, it's kind of been a contentious topic over the last year and a bit.
So the meeting was under the Chatham House Rule, and I'm reading from the Google. It's a framework for fostering open dialogue in meetings, enabling participants to use shared information while protecting the identity and affiliation of speakers. It allows for honest discussion of sensitive topics without fear of public attribution, originally established in 1927.
So the basic idea is that the various folks can come, including people from the U.S. consulate, but they're not really officially on the record.
Yes.
So we can't say, this person who has this position at the consulate or, you know, it said this and that means that's what the United States is saying and things like that. It's more like we're here to talk about these issues and share for the purposes of understanding.
Well, for the purposes of what we're going to do right now, it says here, participants are free to use the information received, but neither the identity nor the affiliation of speakers nor the head of any other participant may be revealed. Now, one will be revealed by me as me. I think so. That's fair enough.
I think you're allowed to speak on your own behalf.
It was about trade and so on, other issues between the United States and Canada. One impression I got was that they weren't offensive like the ambassador to Canada from the United States. Pete, what's his name? I mean, he's a nasty guy.
And he'd definitely been going around saying a lot of undiplomatic things.
Yeah, and we're to blame for all this. So, I got reprimanded. They said, what is your question? I said, my question is, what do you think of my statement? So, I wasn't able to kind of follow up, but to paraphrase myself, I said, Donald Trump says he wants to take over Canada. He has caused an economic war, and it's not our fault. Mm-hmm. And I think that Doug Ford was right for doing those ads because he was telling truth. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the officials said something to the kin of, well, he was interfering in elections, which is you shouldn't do as a... And I think I did speak up. I said, but you are interfering on us with your tariffs and all this. And then that was about it.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like that Pete, what's his name? You would just mention his name, Magnus, whatever. Pete the Terrible. Okay, we know who he is. He was mainly kind of, well, not quite whitewashing it, but kind of downplaying it, you know. So it was more... respectful in tone in general. Some of the people were sort of there prior to the second Trump term as such. So somebody, a retired diplomat living now in Vancouver, he kind of took my side. So there you go.
Did you feel validated by that?
Do I feel validated?
Did you?
Oh, I was too busy just... one of the guys, I think he was a bit kind of slightly shaken by my tone. And I did talk with him and a few other people afterwards.
Right.
So that's... I think it's maybe hard for a lot of the officials now, except for Pete, of course.
Pete Hoekstra. That's his name.
Hoekstra. Oh, yeah, he seems to just say, it's our fault. I mean, he's really big on that. Somebody told me, I was talking about the head of the consulate here in Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
He's Pete Hoselet. What's his name? Whatever. Anyway, he is above him, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
So who's above Pete? Is DeSantis?
I guess because DeSantis is the Secretary of State.
Yes.
So I guess the, you know, and the diplomatic corps works within the Department of State.
And then above him, of course, is the bad guy.
The president.
Yeah. My editorial opinion of the day. Yeah. I think, I don't, did Pete, what's his name, did he get appointed right after Trump came in again for the second term, Magnus?
Yeah, he was been out ambassador since about a year now, since April 2025.
So he's sympathetic to the administration.
Well, he's definitely, you know, I mean, I guess he would be because, you know, everybody within this administration seems to be appointed for their loyalty to the president.
What I think,
above all other issues.
Yeah, I know. What I think is different from the first Trump term, the second one, is that the first one, I think he may have been taken by surprise he won.
Mm-hmm.
But what he did was that he, there were all these people he had to appoint. And there was probably some input from other people who should be appointed. And basically he took what they said, in a sense. And then that stupid wall thing, he closed down the people weren't paid, like they weren't paid recently over the wall thing. But other than that, I think he was being kind of more, the administration was running things. Now he's on top of the administration, and he picked up these flunkies who are just going to agree with him, like that lumpkin person, who I think, I think before he was appointed, you have to address either the Senate or the House of Representatives.
Well, yep, they have to do confirmation hearings before the Senate for any of those cabinet positions.
Wait, before the Senate. And I saw his presentation, and he's a liar, because one of the senators said, do you understand how the auto sector is basically integrated? Mm-hmm. Well, once he said, he totally forgets that. So he lied. He's a liar and a rotten guy.
Yeah.
So
that
I guess...
That seems to be pretty standard for all of those Senate confirmation hearings, including the ones prior to that for the Supreme Court justices, where they just said what senators wanted to hear.
Yeah.
And once they got in office, it's like, well, no, we're just doing... We're doing whatever we think we want to do.
What's interesting is that the Supreme Court... loaded with Trump appointees, is still disagreeing with them.
Not as much as a lot of people think they should, though.
They still are. I think they disagreed with them on tariffs that last...
They did.
So I'll leave you for last words for a wind-up, Magnus.
Well, I'm not sure what to add to this other than, I think we can expect more strangeness and somewhat hostile... And at best, difficult relations we got almost 3 3/4 months, 3 3/4 years to go before, Trump is out. It's going to be really interesting to see what happens in the fall.
2 3/4 years.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you. it's going to be interesting to see what happens in the fall with the midterm elections,
Biden. Which he may, one of the issues is, for example, women who have got married and they changed their name to their husband. Suppose he got to get a whole new ID now.
They've trying to put in ID requirements, and really strict requirements that, if your ID doesn't exactly match, your name. So in the case of, say, someone who's married and they've changed their name and now they're going to restrict voting, mail-in balloting, which is... It represents a substantial portion of people casting their ballots. They're doing what they can. Steve Bannon has on more than one occasion, who's not part of the administration officially, but definitely a Trump ally, has talked on more than one occasion about, having them send ICE to polling stations, and given them, which would be a way to sort of harass people of color, right? Anyone who looks like they... are Latino or otherwise, whether they're a citizen or not, maybe if that happens, could expect to be harassed. And I think the idea would be to keep a lot of those folks away from the polls, because people don't want to go and get rounded up and then, it takes 3 or 4 days to prove who they are and they miss the chance to vote and they've lost work and sometimes lost jobs. It could be a real mess.
What's a bit racist about that on one level is that if you're black... and you speak English, even in what would be called a black accent, that kind of proves you are born in the United States. Because where else would you, be speaking like that? And you're black, so.
Yeah.
And so, anyway, hopefully the Senate and House of Representatives will be a majority of Democrats.
Well, we'll see what happens in November, and until then, we just got to hold on. Thanks for chatting today, Peter.
Okay.
That's our show for today. Thanks for tuning in to CJSF 90.1 FM. Speak Up will be back on your radio dial tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. with Danny Nesvadarani in the host chair. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Coming up in just a few moments. Wandering Rhythms will be up at 12 noon. And... typically Tuesday up at 3, and a whole bunch of new great shows coming up, including new show Nerve and Wire this evening. Tune in for that. And
My name's Katie. You want some cool new music to listen to? Want to know about up-and-coming artists, albums, and more? Well, come hang with me every Tuesday from 12 to 1. Raccoon City's where I'll be. Hope to see you there.